This is an Alien UFO Podcast classic episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. There are a number of UFO episodes that I released on the podcast a few years ago, and they're full of great information, and I thought it'd be a good idea to share them for listeners who may have missed them the first time around. This episode dates back to August 2022. It features my conversation with Ross Coulthard about his book, In Plain Sight, An Investigation into UFOs and Impossible Science. Ross is an award-winning investigative journalist and writer, previously an investigative reporter on news and current affairs programme 60 Minutes on Channel 9 in Australia, and chief investigations reporter for Sunday Night News programme. Coulthard has won 5 prestigious Walkley Journalism Awards, including the most coveted top award for Australian journalism, the Golden Walkley. His broadcast television investigative journalism has also won the top broadcast award, a Logie. His documentary, The UFO Phenomenon, is available on YouTube. Hi, Ross. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
It's a pleasure.
I saw your book, In Plain Sight, which is just fascinating, and you've obviously done a lot of research to put it together. And I watched your documentary, The UFO Phenomenon, which is on YouTube, have over 6 million views now. That's fascinating.
It's actually it's about the fourth iteration of that video, and if you add up all the different iterations as to the platforms that it's been on, it's actually over 11 million views, which is phenomenal. I always laugh when TV networks tell me that nobody's interested in the UFO issue because people are fascinated. They want to engage.
One of the things that I like about your book and about your documentary is it's very level-headed. You don't go crazy. You don't go into all that ancient alien stuff. And it's very sort of sober look at it, isn't it?
I hope so. I mean, I think what I perceive that I'm doing is applying the skill set in investigative journalism to the issue of what is, I think, the biggest mystery on the planet right now. I mean, you have this really interesting situation where a large percentage of the world's media, probably the overwhelming majority, is still locked into an old-fashioned paradigm that says that this is all rubbish, it should be ridiculed, it's a subject that should be dealt with mockery. And yet you've got the Pentagon, the most powerful military on the planet, has formally admitted in a report to Congress that it cannot explain the phenomenon that is being recorded by its pilots, and indeed we know has been being recorded by military officials and commercial air pilots for many, many years before that. Finally, there is the beginning, I think, of an acknowledgement from the United States government, in addition to increasingly the French, less so to my country, and certainly not yours. The Brits have still got their head in the sand. But I think there's the beginning of an acknowledgement, and there's some extraordinary noises coming from people in Congress who are indicating very strongly that they want to have hearings. They basically want further transparency and disclosure of whatever it is that the US government knows.
And you talk in the documentary about a report that was going to be presented. Did that come through? Has it been delayed?
No, the documentary was made originally in May, June of last year, and that was when I was traveling in America, and there was a lot of talk that the Congress in December of 2020 had ordered the Pentagon to make a report from its UAP task force on essentially a brief preliminary report on the phenomenon. And so that report came down on June the 25th while I was still in the United States. And it wasn't earth-shattering, but in and of itself, the admissions that it made were very significant because it started with, I think, the fiction that this phenomenon began in 2004, which I think is a deliberate policy by the Pentagon to try and constrain the narrative to the immediate sort of period since 2004, because they don't want to talk about what the US government knew and has known since 1947. But even with what it investigated since 2004, it acknowledged that there were 144 incidents that had been looked at by the Pentagon's expert investigators. And out of those 144 incidents, it could not explain prosaically 143 of them. And I've spoken to people in Congress, people in the defense and intelligence services who've told me about confidential briefings that were given to congressmen and their staffers by people in the intelligence services and the defense force in the United States. And they've made it very, very clear that there are other videos in addition to the so-called YouTube videos, the gimbal, the GoFast, and the Tic Tac, that go well beyond what people have already seen publicly, and that they're just the tip of the iceberg of videos and other information that the Pentagon and the US intelligence community is sitting on that they're now weighing up whether to disclose. And I think there's a concern that to show some of the data would reveal sources and methods, which frankly I can understand. I mean, I've been briefed about telemetry data that's been obtained from satellites here in Australia, and I don't think America or its allies, Australia and the UK included, would want potential adversaries to know the capabilities of defense systems. So I'm not making excuses for the Pentagon, but I can kind of understand why there's a caution about revealing some of these videos. But I think at some stage they will be made public. And I think people are going to be quite shocked. And it will put the question as to whether or not this phenomenon is real beyond any doubt. But frankly, we've been beyond that position since June the 25th last year, because the Pentagon has formally admitted that this is real. And that's extraordinarily significant.
It's just amazing what they've got, what they might have. And it could be that they've got a plan to drip feed it out over the years. And every time it's a new video, it's a little bit more clearer, a little bit more obvious what it is.
I'm not so sure that there is a deliberate policy of intentional disclosure by either the intelligence community or the Pentagon, because I think they're hopelessly compromised by the ridiculous secrecy that's persisted during and since the Cold War. I think a decision was made to suppress and ridicule and mock and stigmatize the subject matter of UAPs for decades since the 1950s. And ever since the Condon report, the Robertson panel, essentially there's been a view that the whole issue should be shut down and kept secret, internalized inside air forces and intelligence groups that for assessment. But what I was shocked by as a so-called mainstream media journalist who uses the skill set, if you like, of investigative journalism to approach this subject matter, is that when I started reaching out to sources and engaging with them as a journalist does and saying, you know, what's the story here? And I fully expected to be told that this is all rubbish, that essentially, you know, we should be very skeptical about these claims and there's not much in it. Instead, I was being told, actually, this is real. And yes, this is a mystery. Or in some cases, I was being told by people that that's the party line. We're going to be told that it's a mystery and that we're going to be fed this line that we don't really know what it is and that we're now investigating when in fact we know a lot more than we're letting on. I don't know yet what the answer is, but I do accept that there's a mystery that is worthy of investigation, and I think it's probably the biggest mystery of all. And one of the things that I find fascinating is that there's been a chronic failure of the mainstream media here. It has allowed itself to be misled. It's allowed itself to be deceived by treating the subject matter of the phenomenon with ridicule and contempt and dismissiveness. And there's a cognitive dissonance now between what the Pentagon and the US government has formally admitted, what congressmen are saying, you know, people like Andre Carson, people like Marco Rubio, you know, there are people saying that this phenomenon is worthy of intense investigation because there is a genuine mystery here. But you have sections of the American media that are basically saying, you know what, we're just going to ignore this because we just don't think it's worth looking at. And I just find that bewildering. I really do. And I think the media, it's incumbent on the media to realize when it's been snowed. And it should start digging and investigating, because there's a very interesting story there.
And the secrecy was just over the top in the past. When you talk about in the book how Jimmy Carter was elected president and he went to the CIA head, who just happened to be a guy called George Bush, and the CIA refused the president information because they said it was on a need-to-know basis.
Yeah, this is an assertion that's being made by attorney, civil rights attorney Gen Sheehan, who's a very well-known civil rights attorney and advocate for transparency on the UAP issue. And look, I freely admit I was skeptical when Dan Sheehan told me this, and so I'd actually put it to all of the parties involved. I've tried to elicit a response, as journalists are expected to do, from all of the parties involved. And the hilarious thing is nobody wants to talk about this, but Dan's allegation is that he was approached by the space policy advisor in the Carter White House, a woman called Marcia Smith. And she invited him initially at first to assist in investigations that basically required his assistance as somebody connected to the Jesuit Church. And he basically facilitated some research that they wanted done and approached the Vatican on the Carter White House's behalf to see whether the Vatican would cooperate with opening its archives for investigation into UAPs. And interestingly enough, they refused at the time. This is back in the 1970s. And then as a result of other work that he did, where he essentially helped lobby for the maintenance of the CETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence funding in the Congress, he was invited to take part in a project that Jimmy Carter apparently requested, which was essentially a briefing on UAPs. You know, what did the US government know about the phenomenon? And this is something that I would have expected every president should and would ask, but clearly they haven't all done this. But Dan tells a very compelling story about how when Marcia asked him to do this work, and I've put this to Marcia and she hasn't responded conspicuously, when she was asking him to do this work, he said, look, I'll only really do this if you allow me access to the classified records of Project Blue Book. And, of course, Project Blue Book was the Air Force's 10-year-long investigation into UFOs, which culminated in late 1969, early 1970, and essentially led down to the formal shutting down of the UAP issue and a declaration from the US Air Force that whatever these things were, they could probably be explained prosaically. They were no threat to national security or flight safety. And that's been the official position of the US Air Force, the British Air Force, the Australian Air Force, and most of the Five Eyes Air Forces around the world ever since. And frankly, it was a lie. Because what Dan Sheehan told me was that, to his great surprise, a few weeks after he made this request for access to the classified volumes of Blue Book, probably because he was doing this research for the US president, he was told by Marcia Smith that he would indeed be given access to those classified files, which theoretically aren't meant to exist. You know, theoretically, Project Blue Book has been declassified, and theoretically, all of its files are now public information. We know that to not be the case at all. So in very cloak and dagger style, he was told to turn up to the Madison Building, which at the time was an incomplete building in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., on a Saturday morning. And he turns up with his lawyer's briefcase and a notepad under one arm and walks up to the Madison Building, and there are two men in black suits waiting there for him, and they usher him into the basement of this building, and he's taken into a highly secure room. And while he's being led into that room, he's told that he can't take his bag in, but he manages to tuck his pad underneath his arm, and he secretes that into the room. And then he's ushered into this room where there's on a long table microfiche, boxes and boxes and boxes of microfiche. And there's a microfiche viewer. They close the door and leave them to it. So he starts going through these microfiche. And the story he tells is quite extraordinary because he realizes that yeah, sure, these are indeed the classified unreleased Project Blue Book files. But a large volume of them are just too wordy to even begin to wade through in the short time that he has available. So he does what we all do with panicking, and he starts looking for photographs, things that can easily explain what he's looking at. So he's high-speed scrolling through the microfiche. He goes through one roll of microfiche, looking for a photo. There's nothing there. Goes through another roll, nothing there. And then on the third roll, he stops in shock, and he tells the story really well, Dan. And he's told the story now for 30 years, and nobody who's involved ever has contradicted him. He says that what he found himself looking at were high-quality, black-and-white, 1940s-era photographs of U.S. soldiers dressed in 1940s kit, retrieving what looked to him like a crashed flying saucer craft of some kind. And he says that he could clearly see symbols around the top cupola of the craft or object or whatever it was, clearly some kind of constructed, intelligently designed object of a metallic nature sitting in what looked like a snowdrift. And not surprisingly, the way Dan tells it, he panicked. Because for him, this was the realization that this was all real. And he, as an assigned consultant, if you like, for the president, was being shown data that had not and has never been released, which clearly showed U.S. soldiers retrieving some kind of intelligently constructed technology that, as far as we know, is not of this earth. And he secreted his shorthand pad under his arm, and so he put it up under the microfiche viewer and drew the symbols that were on the side of this craft. And then the way he tells it, he sneaked out of the room with the pad under his arm, managing to avoid detection by the officials involved, and got out of the building. And what alarms me, and I think should alarm everybody, is that in the subsequent volumes of the report that went to the president that he was given a preview of, there was no mention of what he'd seen in those Project Blue Book files. President Carter was not told. Now, I think that raises very serious issues of accountability. And we have to ask, not just in that incident, but in multiple incidents where presidents have asked for briefings, have presidents been lied to? For example, when, as I write in my book, In Plain Sight, President Obama sought and received a briefing from his science advisors about UFOs, he's said publicly that he was told that the US is not aware of any non-human intelligence that's engaging with this planet, certainly not aware of any recovered craft or spacecraft. And he said this publicly. And we know also that his science advisor put out a press release to that effect in 2011. Was the president lied to? Was the president deceived? Have presidents been lied to? And could it be that the reason why the public internationally is not being told the full story about this is because there really is a cadre of people in the defense community and the intelligence services who have lied and deceived various administrations going back decades?
I really like the chapter you have. Is it Dr. Salvatore Pays, Puzzling Patents?
Ah, yes.
And some of the stuff in there reminds me of what Bob Lazar was talking about that he was working on.
Okay, let me talk about Dr. Pay, because I've been talking to Dr. Pay, and he's going to appear hopefully in a week or two on Kurt Jaimungal's Theories of Everything. I don't know what to make of Dr. Pay's Puzzling Patents, as I call the chapter in my book. And the fundamental weakness, he's very, very convinced that what he's discovered is real, and that he has discovered the secrets of essentially anti-gravity, a propulsion system that would allow, apparently, the displacement of space-time by creating a warp bubble in front of a craft and allowing it to displace space and time instantaneously. I mean, it's the answer to propulsion. Now, this is a very dramatic claim being made by a hitherto unknown defense scientist who was working out of the Navier section of the Patuxent U.S. Navy Research Section in Washington, D.C. What's fascinating is that his bosses, a commander by the name of James Sheehy, supported his applications for a patent for a range of different devices, including a force field generator, a transmedium vehicle, a fusion reactor, and essentially technology that sounds like something out of Star Trek. And a lot of scientists who've reviewed his data say that he doesn't have the evidence that he asserts that he has. Notably, his bosses have asserted that the technology that, in some cases, that provides the basis for his patents, they've asserted that it's, quote, operable. Well, at this stage, I haven't seen any evidence from him or anyone that there is operable technology. It still seems to be based on theory. But what's interesting is that the US Navy knows that if you make a false patent application, if you ground a patent in falsehoods, that patent is invalid. Because one of the possible explanations that was put by skeptics was that maybe this was an attempt by the US government, the US military, to avoid having to pay any other nation for this technology if and when it's cracked or discovered by any other nation or any other individual. And so if they assert that they've discovered this patent before, then they can not have to pay for the rights to use that patent by any other country. And I've put that to Salvatore. I said, you know, is it possible that this is what's happened? Is it possible that your government's just trying to avoid having to pay bills for propulsion systems that will be discovered in the future? And he's adamant that what he's discovered is real. But as people will learn soon enough, he feels very strongly that his contribution to science is being under-acknowledged and overlooked. So I think it'll be for science to judge. It'll be for his colleagues and peers to judge whether what he asserts that he's discovered is real.
Could we get on to your chapter two, Roswell Implausible Denials? One thing that stands out for me in that, the thought of Roswell, is that it was Lieutenant Walter Hart released the press release initially saying that they'd captured a disc and that they had one. And then the next day they say it's a weather balloon. What my point is that they're trying to suggest that these military personnel can't tell the difference between a disc and a weather balloon.
It's funny because the people who were accused of confusing a disc for a weather balloon are not the people who ordered the issuing of the press release. That's the really interesting thing to me about Roswell, is that it was the commanding general of the 504th Bomb Battalion, the people who actually dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was a man of great repute, ordered his PR officer to put out a press release asserting that the United States Air Force had recovered, quote, a flying disc. Now, this was subsequently misreported by the media, not the first time, as the US Air Force had recovered a flying saucer. But needless to say, the mere assertion of a recovered flying disc in that period of 1947, where there'd been almost hysterical numbers of public sightings of discs all over the continental USA, starting with Kenneth Arnold's sighting over Mount Rainier in Washington State in north of California. It was quite clear that the public were hyper-vigilant for flying discs, flying saucers. You know, there was a lot of speculation that something was happening, that some kind of space object was visiting this planet. So for the Air Force to put out a press release like that was just quite extraordinary. And I've never really understood why people attach so much significance to the fact that the intelligence officer, Jesse Marcel, who was subsequently accused of making this confusion, was forced to pose with what was clearly weather balloon detritus in the office of his general, and essentially forced to go through the humiliating back down of publicly displaying wreckage that was clearly a weather balloon. Nobody ever disputes that. But the idea that it was he who authorized the distribution of a press release, there's no way that any commanding officer of probably one of the most sensitive units in the US Air Force at the time in 1947 would have issued the statement asserting that a disc had been recovered unless they knew for sure that a disc had been recovered. And this is why I think there is a paucity of analysis and a willingness to be credulous on both sides relating to Roswell. Because I think modern ufology has allowed itself to be led a little too easily with Roswell, in the sense that people have, I think, too readily leapt to conclusions that there was definitely an Air Force cover-up, that there were bodies recovered, that there were spaceships recovered. We just don't know enough to say that for sure. The conclusion that I came to in my book was that indubitably lies were told. Indubitably, the Air Force put out a press release asserting that a flying disc had been recovered, and then it did a backflip and retracted that and forced Jesse Marcel, their intelligence officer, to pose with what was clearly weather balloon material. And then, look, frankly, the issue died because the media in the 1940s swallowed that lame explanation. And it wasn't until the 1980s when researchers started digging Marcel was tracked down, and he admitted or asserted that he had been told to lie and that he knew full well that the material that he was posing with in that celebrated photograph was not what was found on the farm, and that he was well aware that there were indeed recovery operations that were undertaken by the US Air Force, and that it was contemporaneously with the cover-up, it was a recovery operation that involved allegedly the recovery of craft. Now, I know that back in the 1990s, under pressure from different congressmen, the US Air Force subsequently tried to say that what it was really a mobile spy balloon, which was a particular type of high-altitude balloon that carried an array underneath it. But the problem was that when you do the analysis and actually look at what the Mogul balloon looked like, it bore no resemblance to what people say they saw. It cannot plausibly explain. And even the Air Force, in its clumsy efforts to try and cover up what it actually knows, issued another amendment. And in 1994, they issued a laughable, a risible statement where they called it Roswell case closed, I think, in vainglorious hope that they could once and for all put a nail through this coffin. And they asserted totally implausibly that what people had seen that looked like humanoids, tiny little humanoids, aliens if you like, were in fact crash dummies that were dropped in the 1950s from balloons to test the impact of falling aerial objects on the ground. Now, quite apart from the fact that people were adamant that they'd seen these objects in the 1940s, not in the 1950s, the crash dummies that they referred to were far too large to adequately explain the supposed humanoids that were recovered in the 1940s. It just didn't ring true. And frankly, the Air Force has tied itself up in knots with the ridiculous lies that it definitely has told about Roswell. And frankly, where I've come to as a journalist is, yes, lies have been told. The Air Force, the US Air Force, has admitted lying. It has formally admitted a cover-up. But then it's tied itself up with a double backflip with Pike in lying even further. And frankly, the credibility and the plausibility of the US Air Force is in tatters with the current remaining explanation for Roswell, which just doesn't ring true. And okay, you've got the statement that, as you rightly assert, a guy called Lieutenant Walter Hout, in retirement on his deathbed, signed, where he asserted that he was shown by his commanding general at Roswell a craft that was retrieved and put in the hangar at Roswell before it was finally sent on to Wright Pat. Now, you might assume that I would go, oh, well, case closed. Walter Hart signed a statement. That's the end of the matter. It must be true that they've recovered an alien spacecraft. But there are problems with Walter Hart's affidavit. Firstly, he previously signed another affidavit during his lifetime where he asserted that there was no such recovered craft and he wasn't aware of any such thing. So he perjured himself. He's declared a willingness to lie under oath. So that immediately, in my view as a journalist, puts his credibility in question. So, frankly, the best I can say about Roswell is that, yes, there is a mystery there. Yes, the Air Force lied. Yes, there are witnesses who say that they saw a craft of some kind, but nothing that anybody has said publicly can be treated as definitive because there's been so many lies told and been so much pressure put on people to lie. And there have been confabulators and hoaxers who've entered the mix as well, who've muddied the waters. I just find it impossible to be sure one way or the other. But the only way to definitively to get to the bottom of this is to go and find new sources, new source material, which is what I set out to do when I did my book. And so I wrote letters to the people that I thought might know something. And one of the people that I wrote to was Matt Kobetz, the former Director of Science and Technology Development for the US Navy, one very big kahuna in the United States military infrastructure. And he, probably because he was on his deathbed, knowing that he was going to be dead within a few months, gave me his candid acknowledgement that, yes, he was aware of the program. He was aware of briefings that he'd been given where he was told that the United States did recover, allegedly, multiple craft and that there were engineering attempts going on at this time to back engineer that technology. He also told me of a trip that he made as an expert on a particular type of electron beam welding, where he was invited by the US Air Force to go and look at a large lump of metal that he felt he could not explain with any known terrestrial technology. It was bonded in ways at the atomic level that went beyond his understanding of how metals can be bonded. It wasn't an electron beam weld, which is what they thought it might be. It was bonded, he said to me, at the molecular level. And he was fascinated by it because he said it looked like the bulkhead of some kind of craft. And it was two different types of metal that were bonded together in a way that he could not explain. So he introduced me to other people who spoke to me on background and who I still communicate with on a very confidential basis. And they are people who've told me that they are aware of and or working in what is known colloquially inside this secret group as the program. And they assert that there is indeed a secret United States program underway to back engineer recovered non-human intelligently crafted technology. Now, you might think that when I'm told that kind of thing by people speaking to me on both on the record and on background, I immediately assume that it's true. But I can't, because my job as a journalist is to test those allegations and to try to verify them. And there's no way I can verify them. But I do think that there is a substantial reason to believe that the US government either is lying or has been lied to by sections of its defense and military intelligence establishment. What we need to know is why. And this year, 2022, we might just get the beginnings of an answer because the Congress has, by legislation, in the Defence Appropriations Bill for financial year 2022, it has demanded, it has requested, it has ordered the Congress and every section of the intelligence community and every arm of the US government that might conceivably know something about the phenomenon to give a report to the Congress on what they know. Now, it's going to be at the discretion of the Congress whether or not the public get told what the Congress learns. But Congress leaps. So hopefully, at some stage this year, we might get to know. But there is a report that's meant to be delivered at the latest in October this year. So it could very well be that 2022 is a red letter year in terms of getting to the bottom of this mystery. But I'll be honest with you, I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah. The impression I get from your book and from the documentary, there's a lot of history in UFO sightings in Australia. And the stuff you talked about that I hadn't heard about before, particularly at Exmouth, that base with those massive transmitters, but also the Westall sightings, fascinating as well.
Yeah, I think they're the two places in Australia where I think there have been some of the most compelling sightings of anomalous objects that are yet to be explained. I started the book by talking about the Harold E. Holt Naval Communications Station, which is a very remote military base that was built in 1966 by the Americans on a place called North West Cape in one of the most remote parts of Australia. It's about 5,000 kilometres northeast of Sydney, way across on the other side of Australia, sitting on the very edge of the Indian Ocean on an isthmus called North West Cape, near the little town of Exmouth. And in the 1960s, the Americans built this town essentially to build and supply this communications station. And at the time, the then conservative government didn't really tell the public a lot about what this base's purpose was. It was just said to be a Navy communications station run by the Americans. And nobody asked too many questions. But the succeeding Labor governments right through to the 1980s, began to realize that what this station was the communications base through which, in the event of nuclear war, very low frequency signals that could penetrate seawater down to about 80 to 100 feet were able to communicate with nuclear attack submarines, which were deployed by the United States in the Indian Ocean. And the way it's being described to me, they could get a signal to those subs hovering at around about 80 feet out of the rate of detection of satellites, and they would get the order to come closer to the surface, where the same station would then issue the codes to command them to launch their missiles in the event of nuclear war. So one of the things that's very clear with the phenomenon is that there is a definite nexus, an acknowledged link between whatever these objects are, this anomalous sightings of anomalous objects, and nuclear weapons. There's a long history going back decades of nuclear facilities, nuclear weapons building sites like Los Alamos or the Hanford laboratories in the US, different sites across Russia, China, India, Pakistan. They've all been buzzed by these anomalous objects. Whatever it is, it has definitely taken an interest in nukes. Perhaps it has a concern about our use or misuse of nuclear weapons. But I, when I started going through the Australian National Archives, was shown documents which were released by the Defence Department before the formation of our FOI laws, which, funnily enough, now that our FOI laws exist, can no longer be found in Australia's archives. They seem to have, quote, disappeared from Australia's defence archives, but they were released legitimately by Air Force intelligence to various UFO groups in the 1970s. And they showed that there were sightings at this Harold E. Holt Naval Communications Station at a very, very sensitive period during the Arab-Israeli War in 1973, when America, the Nixon White House, Henry Kissinger, not the president, Henry Kissinger, gave the order for the American military to be put to the highest peacetime
readiness when it looked like the world was on the brink of nuclear war. They went from DEFCON 4 to DEFCON 3, the highest peacetime readiness level. DEFCON 2 is, you know, let's get going. And DEFCON 1 is, let's push the bloody button and launch nuclear war. So it was a very, very serious time. And it was prompted by concerns that the Soviets might invade the Middle East and pose a threat to America's ally in Israel and possibly assist Syria in the invasion of Israel. And mercifully, that didn't happen. But as part of America's readiness and preparedness, they readied their submarine force and they ordered them to go to DEFCON 3. And to issue that order, it went through the Harold E. Holt Naval Communications Station. And what we know from the archives is that within hours of that order being issued, staff at the Naval Communications Station, including very probably the deputy commander, an American deputy commander of the base, looked up and saw a solid, spherical, dark charcoal-colored object hovering over or adjacent to the base, just on dusk. It was very, very clear. There are no doubt that what they saw was a solid object. And a fireman by the name of Bill Lynn actually drew a picture of it. And I have that picture in my book. And what he describes is a classic, anomalous, glowing, phosphorescing object that appeared to have some kind of rim, was large and spherical, hovered over the base, and he watched it for quite a few minutes before it zoomed off. Now, that in and of itself is interesting, but what really blew me away was, one, when I went up to Exmouth and spoke to locals, when they finally started opening up to me, it turned out that every man and his dog had been seeing anomalous objects up there for decades. And then I went through the archives again, and I found in the appropriately named DAFI, the Department of Air Force Intelligence, there were files that recorded more sightings at Exmouth, including a sighting by two warrant officers, quite senior members of the Special Air Service, who were doing an exercise at the air base, the Air Force base, immediately adjacent to this secret facility, the Harold E. Holt Naval Communications Station. And at this Air Force base, known as RAF Learmonth, these SAS officers, one of whom I've spoken to, were waiting for a C-130 Hercules to come with a parachute drop of a large number of members of an SAS squadron. And they had a whole series of digital radios that they'd set up so that they can communicate with this approaching Air Force Hercules. And while they were waiting, they saw a spherical object, a glowing spherical object, approach from the horizon at speed and hover over the airstrip. And of course, that posed a navigation hazard. For them, it was a serious concern because they were about to drop a large number of men with parachutes and an aircraft was about to fly over this base. So they had to try and communicate with the plane to call off the aircraft. And so they had four separate digital radios that they sought to communicate with this aircraft with, and unfortunately, none of those radios worked. There was some kind of electromagnetic interference that interfered with their communications. And they watched on helplessly as this object continued to hover over the base, knowing that this aircraft was coming towards them. And for them, it was a serious concern. This was a flight safety hazard. This was a serious issue of flight safety. And also, if not national security, what the hell was this hovering over a very secure military base adjacent to one of the most sensitive U.S. military bases in the world? You know, this is a national security issue. And this is what has now been acknowledged by the U.S. that in its report to Congress last year, it did a double backflip with Pike and admitted that after years of saying that whatever these objects were, they were no threats to flight safety, that they were no national security issue. It begrudgingly admitted, well, you know, it is a threat to flight safety because our pilots are concerned that it's posing a threat to safety, as it was for these two SAS warrant officers. And yes, it is a potential threat to national security. And I actually tracked down one of the retired now SAS warrant officers who signed the report. Incredibly, his name and even his home address at the time were in the file. And I found this gentleman who's now in his 60s, and he happily admitted to me that he'd seen the object, that to him it was a genuine mystery, and that for him it was unexplained, and that he'd reported it to the Air Force Intelligence Branch because he was concerned that it did pose a flight safety hazard to him and his mates. And when I started going through the National Archives files, or not just our Department of Air Force Intelligence, but particularly when you Brits ever so kindly came and tested your nuclear weapons in our desert at a place called Maralinga, and also your ICBMs in a similar part of the South Australian desert, a place called Woomera, there were, from the 1950s right through to the 1960s, a series of anomalous sightings that were well recorded, not only on radar, they were seen by A1 human eyeballs, by scientists, physicists, military witnesses in and around the secure Maralinga and Woomera sites. And in some cases, what they were saying they were seeing were apparently intelligently controlled craft that were hovering over the nuclear test site immediately before or after nuclear weapons tests were going off. This was a clear infraction of what was potentially at the time one of the most sensitive areas in the world, a place where a great power, the United Kingdom, was testing nuclear weapons with Australia. This was a major national security issue. And as a result of that, serious questions were being asked by people in our military and intelligence services. You know, what the hell's going on here? These were being reported back to the United States. And it's quite clear that, at least on the official record, no answer or explanation was ever given. There was a genuine mystery, though, that was acknowledged and recorded in Australia's National Archives, and for all I know, continues to be, even though our Air Force maintains and has recently told Parliament that it takes no interest in the phenomenon, which I know to be, I just want to say this politely, economical with the truth, I think is what your Cabinet Secretary once said.
And it's interesting, there's rock art that I've seen, the Indigenous Australian rock art that looks so interesting with these faces with huge black eyes. And they talk about, is it the Wanjina cloud and the rain spirits and the Min Min lights?
It's the Wanjina cloud and rain spirits up in the Kimberley. I've been privileged enough to travel up there and have a look at these. And they're not carvings, they're actually paintings with ochre that go back tens of thousands of years. And in the Aboriginal Dreamtime stories, the oral history of the Aboriginal tribes right across Australia, there is in the common mythology, and that's not to say it's not true, by the way, I use mythology in the broad sense of essentially untested stories, there is in the common mythology records of these spirits visiting the Aboriginal people. And in fact, there was a term that the European settlers coined for what the Aboriginals were seeing, which they also saw at a town called Min Min in Queensland, in the remote Queensland outback. And they call these the Min Min ghosts or the Min Min spirits. And what they are things that have long been part of Aboriginal Dreamtime stories, these kind of ghostly orbs that float through the outback. And Aboriginal people have described that they've seen these many times and they're unexplained.
So the book is called In Plain Sight, and that's on Amazon. You get it on Kindle. You can get it on paperback. Do you have plans to do another book on this sort of subject matter?
I think before I do a book, I will be doing more media reportage, probably documentaries, probably media investigative stories. There's an awful lot of information coming in the door at the moment that I'm in the process of currently investigating. I'm freelancing as a journalist. I do contribute to a network, a major TV network here in Australia that is interested in the phenomenon as a story subject matter. And I'm getting a lot of phone calls and messages and emails from journalists all over the world now who are taking a much broader interest in the phenomenon because they can see that the United States is not resiling from admitting that whatever it is, it's real. And let me emphasize here, Simon, none of us are saying this is little green men. I actually think that's a glib explanation for what we're talking about here. I mean, people like the former head of the Pentagon UFO project, Lou Elizondo, and others have hinted very broadly that what this might be is something interdimensional. But what they're not resiling from is that humanity may very well be on the cusp of an admission or an acknowledgement that we are not alone, that there is indeed another intelligence in this universe that has superior technology to ours and which we're beginning to learn about. And I think, personally, that is the biggest story of our time. And sooner or later, the rest of the mainstream media will wake up to that fact. But I hope they don't wake up too soon, because I'm actually having far too much fun digging into it by myself with nobody else chasing my shoulder.
Well, it's been great talking to you, and I highly recommend your book. It's so well written, so easy to read, and you just keep going because you don't want to stop because it's so interesting. And so thanks a lot for being a guest on the podcast, and maybe we'll talk again sometime.
It's a pleasure, Simon. All the best to you and your listeners.
And that was an interview with Ross Coulthard about his book, In Plain Sight, An Investigation into UFOs and Impossible Science. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of the episodes. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.